Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Another busy programme ahead of us today. We'll be hearing from Aidan and Ilana a little bit later on, but we start tonight in studio here, Niall Hatch, and at home in Malahide, Dr. Richard Collins. And Niall, news of Alpine swifts visiting Ireland. Is that common, uncommon? I thought we had swifts here all the time.
Well, we have the common swift here during the summer months, one of our last migrants to arrive. So for bird watchers, as a general rule of thumb, if you see a swift of any kind turning up in, let's say, in month of March, chances are it's going to be a rare vagrant visitor rather than our own breeding common swifts. Like our common swift, they spend the winter in sub-Saharan Africa and then return to Europe and indeed to parts of Asia to nest. But it's very much a southern European species, and as the name suggests, Alpine swift. They tend to be associated with the Alps and high mountains, places like the Pyrenees as well. You will find them around some towns around the Mediterranean as well. It's a very impressive bird. It's much larger than our common swift, about twice the size. And they really look like a giant sand martin, unlike our swift, which to all intents and purposes look like a completely dark bird, a real black coloured bird when you see it flying overhead. The Alpine swift is a much paler sandy brown above, white below, so it has a white chest, it has a white throat and a brown band across its chest, so just like a sand martin, that member of the swallow family. So they look very different to our swifts. The body shape is very similar, but they're a lot larger, tend to fly very rapidly high in the sky, as the name swift would suggest. They're very, very quick. So amazing to see so many of them here in Ireland.
Richard, there were some reports, I believe, of Alpine swifts been spotted in Rogerstown, which is not a million miles away from where you live. Have you ever seen them there?
I have not seen them in Rogerstown, but I've seen them in the Alps, in the Jura, in the Pyrenees. I love the mountains, and Alpine swift is a very evocative bird that you see there. Now, I have a theory about them. Of course, like all such theories, it's probably totally wrong. But the theory I have is this. It's big. Now, why would it be big? Well, if you're going to be in a very cold place, it pays to be big. If you're a whale and you live in the cold sea, get as big as you can get, as big as the food supply enables you to be. And I suspect that these Alpine swifts are larger because of the austere, cold places in which they breed and in which they have to survive. Of course, that has implications because you must pay the rent, you must pay the bill, the energy bill. And one thing you don't find much of up in the Alps is insects. And these things are trawlers. They open the bill wide and they scoop up the insects. Although it might look to us as though it's costing them a fortune to fly around, they fly so effortlessly, perhaps, that they can get by on a limited supply of insects. Now, they're coming north because, naturally, Ireland at this time of year is not so different temperature-wise to the Alps or the Jura or someplace like that. So they've come here. But it's great to see them, I must say.
OK, well, look, they're up in the air and they spend most of their lives up in the air. The swifts. Now, something that spends a lot of time on the ground, a lot of time in the air as well, are swans. And you know all about swans, Richard. You did your PhD on population dynamics in mute swans. Now, just a moment, we're going to talk to Kendru Calhoun about hooper swans. We've got the hooper swan, the Buick swan, and the mute swan here in Ireland. So we've got three species. And honestly, even at this stage in the game, I don't know how many years since I met you first, Richard, it must be nearly 30 years ago now when you were ringing mute swans, and I think that was along the River Dodder somewhere, I would still be unsure of which is which at a distance. So you tell the listener now how you can tell them apart.
Go and see the Book of Kells, because Celtic art is curvy linear. It's lovely sweeping S shapes and bends and sickle shapes and all that sort of thing. Well, the mute swan is like that, curved, a beautiful curved neck, all beautiful Celtic curvature, and the tail is cocked up. Hooper swan, on the other hand, is different. It is perpendicular, angular. The neck is straight, not curved. It comes straight up. The head juts forward at right angles to the neck. The bill has no lovely berry on it. It's a yellow and black spike. And above all, let it tell you who it is. it honks all the time. Honk, honk, honk. I can't imitate it very well. The call of the wild, Derek, is the call of the whooper swan, or the trumpeter swan, which you and I heard on our trip to North America. Do you
Virginia,
remember that most memorable?
All those years ago,
it was gorgeous. Now, it is the most wonderful sound, and it gave its name not only to itself because it whoops, but it gave its name to the swan we are all familiar with, the mute swan, because in contrast, the mute is very discreet and silent. Mm. It's not totally silent. It has about 16 different calls and hisses and grunts and snorts and things. But in relation to the lovely whooper sound, it's very silent indeed. Is that any help in telling
Well, it
them
is.
Apart?
Yeah, it is. And if one is nice, kind of curvy and all that kind of stuff, and Book of Kelsey, and the other one is more linear, straight back in the army, stand on there, straight up. But what about the Buick swan? Because I mentioned the Buick as well.
Well, the Buick is a smaller version of the Hooper. I remember our friend, that swan expert, Bill Sladen. Do you remember Bill? Yes, mm-hmm. Bill Sladen. He was the swan man of America. He held that, in fact, the trumpeter, the tundra swan, which is the equivalent of our Buick swan in America, the Buick and the Hooper are one species. He did not think they were separate species at all. Now, the Buick swan was controversial. Now it's established, perhaps we must regard it as a separate species. It's smaller than the Hooper, but it is very similar to look at. It's perpendicular again, yellow and black bill, different pattern perhaps, more black than yellow. It's a small version of the Hooper. Comes to us, very few left now, about a dozen come here now, from Siberia. I remember back in the Wexford slobs in the 60s, you would see 400 of them.
Not anymore.
At the time, they were very... But they are gone. It's because they're short-stopping, they think. They don't have so far to come from Siberia now because they find places, due to global warming, conducive to them in winter, far nearer to their summering grounds, their breeding grounds. So they don't have to come all the way to Britain and on to Ireland anymore. That is the theory. Don't worry about it. You won't be seeing too many of them, at least if you don't if you don't travel abroad.
Anyway, you mentioned the sound of the Hoopers. What you're listening to now is the honking sound of the Hooper Swan over County Wexford, if you don't mind. They are a winter visitor to the wetlands throughout Ireland from October to April and nest in Iceland during the summer months. But here's a rather startling figure. Hooper Swan populations grow, can you believe it? Wait for it, 30 times faster in nature reserves than they do in non-protected areas. Seems a bit obvious to me. Anyway, researchers looked at 30 years of data on Hooper Swans at 22 sites in the United Kingdom and found that population growth was so strong that many moved to non-protected sites. I wonder what impact that'll have here. Well, we're going to find out. We're going to speak now to Kendru Calhoun, an ecological consultant, and he joins us now from Malin Head in Donegal, where he's trying to catch barnacle geese, of all things. Kendru, set the scene.
Well, I'm extremely lucky
here
to be overlooking Tobago Bay, having been watching the barnacle geese, which have been evading me for the last 3 days. I've watched them go out to the sea to roost. They go out to an island off on the mouth of the bay here. I can see Fannet Lighthouse and Torrey Lighthouse, and it's just beautiful.
Kendru, for my money, the barnacle goose, I think, is one of our most attractive winter migrant visitors to Ireland. There's just something really very special about them. They're mainly black and grey coloured geese, but they have a black neck, but a lovely white face and a very dainty, dinky little beak that gives them a very cute look. And this is the species as well that historically in Ireland, particularly among monks during Lent and on Fridays, it was believed, or at least they pretended perhaps, that these were actually fish or seafood or sea creatures rather than birds, so they could actually eat their meat. The origin of the name barnacle goose is it was actually believed that the young geese were actually goose barnacles in the sea, and that the geese then would transform from the barnacles into adult geese in kind of the way that a caterpillar transforms into a butterfly and then would take flight so that people would eat them. Now, how much of that was wishful thinking and how much of it was genuinely believed, I don't know. But the barnacle goose was meat that was eaten on Fridays in Ireland and elsewhere as well. So quite a fascinating species and a good big place in Irish culture.
Did you ever taste barnacle geese, Richard Collins?
No, I did not, and I never tasted Brent geese. They are said to be rather fishy tasting, and people have said that to me, but I don't know if that is true. They are a beautiful bird, and being wanted, they may be more wondered at. They are the hardest of our geese to see. You have to make great efforts to go and see them, visiting islands and that sort of thing. But you appreciate it all the more when you see them. There used to be a fine flock at Lissadel. That was one main and flock. I don't know if that's still there, but it was very impressive to see them. Beautiful, beautiful birds.
Well, we're not really here to talk to Kendrew about barnacle geese today. We're going to talk to him about Hooper swans and this study that has proven they do better in protected areas than outside of protected areas. So, Kendrew, the conch is yours, as they say. Tell us more about this study which you are involved with.
Yes, I saw some lovely Hooper swans earlier on today, and they're on their way to Iceland. They'll leave very soon, in fact, and up in the northern part of the country as their last landfall before they'll make their journey now to Iceland. Any day, I would say, they'll start to go. The research published in the last week, the study that was published by the University of Exeter, the team that I was working with, led that piece of analysis, and it's based on really analysis of colour ringing data. Obviously requires you to catch a swan, put a colour ring on, like Richard would have done lots of times when mute swans. And then it requires lots of people to, not to catch those birds, but obviously to read the ring in the field. The database for Hooper swans is absolutely massive. It's probably hundreds of thousands of records over 30 years. And the analysis just done was analysing that over 30 years. The hypothesis was there any difference in various demographic parameters, survival, productivity and so on, between birds that wintered predominantly in protected areas and those that didn't. And of course, you only know what winters were by reading rings, and you need to do that for very, 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 very many years. And the protected sites are in Great Britain, Kilaverock, Martinmuir and Welney. They're Wildfound Wetlands Trust reserves. And, of course, the wintering range for Hooper swans are all coming from Iceland. They're all over Ireland and Britain. And Ireland has, I think the last census a couple of years ago, had just shy of 20,000 birds. One of our success stories, the increase from the previous census was 27%. So in kind of in line with that short-term increase is our academic findings over the 30-year project. Or analysis of 30 years of data, I should say. And that has shown that the protected sites, the reserves, are really almost like little factories. They are producing the birds there, whilst they're less, they have a lower probability of producing young. The adults have a lower probability of producing young, but they live longer. And the net effect of that, when you do the population modelling and the analysis, is that actually, the net effect is that the population is increasing far higher on birds that are wintering in nature reserves than outside. I think the percentage difference is something like 0.2 or 0.3% population growth for birds that winter in the, you know, in the Shannon Valley and all parts of Ireland, for example, in the rural areas, versus the reserves. It's 6%. So that's a massive difference in the population growth rates, depending on where you spend your winter holidays. And that is very interesting because, of course, protected sites, by their name, we want them to protect the birds there, and we want them to help protect the populations. And actually, they're helping to sustain and indeed to grow the population in the wider wintering grounds and, of course, across the whole flyway by increasing survival rates across all age categories.
Sounds a bit obvious to me, though, to be honest with you, Kendrew, and I'm no scientist, so I don't really understand the ins and outs of this. But if you go to an area that's protected, then you are, by the nature of the place, protected. So more of you will survive, less predators get in there, less harm caused by humans, etc.
Well, you know, we've got, I don't know how many special protection areas in Ireland, European SPAs, and I'm afraid they're not really delivering increases in bird populations. So I totally get your point. But this, what it seems like an obvious thing, is actually very, very seldom proven, because it's very difficult to, of course, disentangle. We expect protected sites to protect the birds and to help the populations, of course, but it's very difficult to understand the population-wide impact. And that's where this is so interesting. The population impact of, when you think about it, protecting one species at only a relatively small number of sites, and actually only for part of the year. The analogy might be, you know, lots of bird tables really being factories to produce increased populations in the countryside. But again, that's very difficult to have proved cause and effect. We found that survival rates were higher for all age classes on birds that were spent time in protected sites, but productivity, the probability was lower. But then, as I say, the net effect was that this massive growth difference, that is definitely driven by the protected sites. And the other thing that was happening is there is a kind of movement of birds, as I say, as almost a factory. The protected sites, there's a net movement over 30 years through time of birds from protected sites out. So it's almost like it's a factory. It's birds don't always stay in the protected sites, but the movement direction of birds is always from protected sites out rather than the other way around, which is partly why the kind of their populations are increasing.
The swan who came in from the cold. Long time ago, when we arrived, the swans had a problem. What to do about us? Well, now, there was a great division among the swans between the mutes, the ones that I studied intensively, and things like whoopers. The mutes said, I think we'll make use of this crowd, people. We'll join them. We'll move into their habitat. We'll use them. We'll make a pact with them. And we'll do well out of that. But the whoopers' attitude was different. We must have nothing to do with people. They are a disaster. Stay away, out in the wild. So here we have a kind of watering down, have we, of that particular decision. The whoopers are saying now, well, we won't quite go into the cities and live next door to them, but we will avail of their protection. It's kind of partial reconciliation between us and the whooper swans. I wonder, is that a fair analysis or a fair observation about this?
I think so. You know, they're exploiting an opportunity, of course. Who wouldn't, when the dinner bell goes at 4 o'clock and you're getting fed and you're relatively safe at night, etc. To know that that's having that sort of impact after, you know, decades of that is quite a rare thing. You know, I know Derek was saying that, you know, protected sites should be protecting and therefore should be protecting populations. But actually, you look at how many times that protected sites, you can actually measure a population-wide impact on a species. It's actually pretty rare. And it's pretty rare to deduce what's going on and to be able to figure out what's going on, what is actually the mechanism behind all of that. And that is where the citizen science and the long-term commitment to that sort of work, it's the only way you can actually understand what's going on is through that sort of approach and that sort of long-term time series of data.
Kendrew, what exactly difficulty does a swan that leaves a protected area and goes to live in the wild, what extra problems does it encounter? What is likely to diminish its life or extinguish its life or prevent it breeding successfully vis-a-vis the ones that stay in the protected areas? What kind of factors are involved there, do you think?
There's obvious things like predation risk, I guess, you know, in a fenced, these reserves are fenced at night, and so whilst foxes won't take too many swans, for example, some will, so there's a definitely a lower predation risk. These birds, for example, will be much less prone to be flying around power lines. So, you know, they'll only be commuting between fields adjacent to the protected area, which is actually still protected because it's part of the reserve, typically, or fields and farmland immediately adjacent to it, vis-a-vis the birds down in the wider countryside, which are, as we know in Ireland, they're flying from Turlough, lake, river or whatever to roost, to forage in fields, and they're flying across hedges and networks of low, medium and high voltage power lines. We know that in certain times, at certain times of year, that can be, there's significant mortality in particular places for that. The difference is actually something that we can't necessarily see, which is things like body condition from the food. So they're better prepared therefore more likely to be productive. That's the kind of subtlety that there'd be a difference. But, you know, it's the survival rates, which was a really interesting thing. And as you say, it's, you know, what's the difference? Well, you know, it's those couple of factors, maybe, you know, not getting disturbed from firemen by farmers who, you know, don't want the swans eating their grass. And, you know, then there's an impact on their energy budgets from getting constantly disturbed. And that has downstream effects on their productivity as well, perhaps.
Does it matter where you're born if you're a swan? Have you extended this to Iceland? The birds are breeding. Some of them are breeding in fairly safe, protected, not quite protected areas there, but others are in very remote areas. Does it matter in later life that you had a very good start, an affluent start?
Very good question. We haven't extended it to that. That's another thing to be explored, Richard. The problem is that lots of the birds that we ring in, or the Wildlife Witness Trust have been ringing in the reserves, you know, they typically catch 100 or 200 birds a year and put rings on their eggs. We actually don't know where they summer. So we don't actually know where they're breeding. Now, obviously, if we go to Iceland and catch birds, if they're breeders, we know where they breed and they're loyal to those sites. So the problem is that we would know the effect of breeding location only on those birds where we had caught in the breeding grounds or happened to recapture that were ringed in the wintertime in their breeding grounds. But the other way around, we don't know unless we catch them. So that would be a harder question to ask. I remember that there certainly is some sort of spatial arrangement. You know, easterly birds in eastern parts of Iceland are far more likely to winter in Britain, and birds in western Iceland are far more likely to winter in Ireland. That's been, you know, that's 10 or 20 year old science on that. But there hasn't been, to be honest with you, there hasn't been a lot of contemporary research done on hoopers. This has just been a piece of work that's based on a 30 year accumulated data set, but there really hasn't been much activity. The last Iceland based activity was maybe a decade ago or so. The steam has kind of run out of that. And it's great. Part of that is, of course, because they're being successful and they're one of, they're doing well, unlike many other birds, unfortunately.
I'd have thought that the great journey across the sea, this is the longest non-stop journey that any swan of any species makes, I think. Now, I remember hearing that at a conference on swans that the idea that they flew very high in the sky on migration, for instance, wasn't really the case. They actually very often fly just over the surface of the sea so that when fog comes or a gale or something, they can land in the sea. Has there been any that you mentioned the research that has stopped, but has there been anything on that since the research has stopped? Is there a choice between having to go high up, 12,000 feet was mentioned, I remember, and that's in memory, or flying just a few feet above the waves? Has anything happened there? Is there any suggestion that one of these techniques is better than the other?
I don't think there's been a massive amount of research on that since. Colin Pennyquick, who did that piece of research, has unfortunately passed away. He was a fairly elderly scientist at when he published that work. And of course, that was a fascinating story because that was inspired by I think air traffic control in Western Scotland or Northern Ireland told a pilot to go and look at what these objects were at you say 12,000 plus feet. And the guy went and he saw some swans. And it was October, and this was, you know, there certainly weren't mute swans at that altitude at that time of year off the north coast of Ireland. Could only have been hoopers. And that's what inspired Colin's work. And I think Colin, you know, basically the conclusion there was, as you say, that lots of birds, it's more efficient and safer for them to fly at low altitude. But on certain occasions, the atmospheric conditions where it's efficient, these birds can fly at high altitude. We satellite tracked some more, and Wildlife Witness Trust have tracked many more actually over the last few decades, and I don't know necessarily the outcome of all of that, but I strongly think that these birds were flying at low altitude, as you say, over the waves, ready to ditch if necessary to rest in bad conditions. I think that that journey for them in spring and autumn migrations, again proven by satellite tracking, has been that the real risk there for them, which is why it pays to stay low, is whenever they encounter conditions that they can't predict. They're halfway across that 800-mile journey, and there's a big front, and they get pushed really far east, and that's when it does. They can run out of steam really, and they ditch, and birds are undoubtedly lost on migration, both migrations due to stormy conditions.
Kendrew, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk to you again soon.
You're very welcome, everyone. Take care.
Now, here's an interesting story. It appears that European diners' penchant for delicacies such as frogs' legs is causing a fatal domino effect in major areas of ecology and biodiversity, scientists have warned. In the last decade alone, about 200 million frogs were imported into the EU, mainly by Belgian firms for French consumers. In Europe, frogs are a protected species under the Habitats Directive, but that has not stopped the trade from countries where various species have been dwindling to the point of a biodiversity crisis. So reads a piece in the Irish Examiner. Co-author of a study looking into the trade is Dr. Sandra Altar, a biologist and wildlife trade expert from the German-based charity Pro Wildlife. She joins us now from her home in Germany. Hello, Sandra. How are you?
Hi. Hello. Greetings to Ireland.
And greetings back to Germany. Now, as I said, you are co-author of a study looking into this trade. Can you tell us a little more about it, please?
Yeah, we did a study together with international herpetologists, which is, for example, Dr. Mark Olia from Germany and Dr. Alice Huge from Hong Kong, and David Bickford. They are all well known for their work in international wildlife trade. And what we were looking for was the role of the European Union as a destination for frogs' legs caught from different countries. And we also investigated the ecological impact of this trade.
And what did you find?
Yeah, what we found out is that the EU is annually importing more than 4,000 tons of frogs' legs, frozen frogs' legs, which is equivalent to about 200 million frogs. And the vast majority of these frogs are caught from the wild. So the impact of this trade is that we have frog populations in the wild declining in different countries. And this is not a new phenomenon. The frogs' legs trade was also already going on in the 1970s and 80s. And at that time, Bangladesh and India were the main supplying countries. And both countries experienced a decline in their wild populations of frogs, which led to an increase of pesticide use. And in the end, both countries decided to stop this trade. But Indonesia jumped in as a new supplier, and over the last decades, frogs came from Indonesia. And what we see in Indonesia now is that there are also declining populations in some areas, and some frogs, which have especially large legs and are highly sought after, they are already declining in the wild. For example, the giant Javan frog has disappeared in French supermarkets. And we have observed a fatal domino effect because this decline is now also happening in other countries. For example, Turkey and Albania in Eastern Europe. And Turkish field biologists just warned that their frogs in Turkey could go extinct if the exploitation for the European market continues, and they might lose their frogs within 10 years.
Well, excuse my ignorance. There's a couple of things. I thought the French were the only people who ate frogs' legs. That's my ignorance. And I also thought that frogs were farmed. You're telling me now they're taking them from the wild and they're depleting the stock, the wild stock that's there.
And the bizarre thing is that within the EU, it's not allowed to commercially collect wild frogs. So the EU is just importing from other countries. And as you said, France is the main consumer. It's not the only one also Belgium and the Netherlands and Luxembourg, and also Germany in at a much lower level. But France is the main consumer and has been since decades.
And of course, Sandra, the big issue here, apart from the fact that these frog species are threatened with extinction and becoming very scarce, there's a vacuum there in nature where therefore there are more insects because there are fewer frogs to feed on them. And then the only way to combat that for many of the farmers in these countries is to use increasingly high levels of pesticides that then get into the water and that affect the frogs that have survived and so on. So it's really a vicious circle, really. How much do you think are the consumers in France and elsewhere in Europe aware of this problem? Is there any movement to try and stop this or try to address it?
I think we are very much at the beginning of an awareness process. We are very glad that our report and our study has caught some attention, and we are already in a dialogue with the EU Commission and also with politicians in France, because we want to see activities by the EU to get these frogs protected on an international level and to reduce the trade.
But with these frogs' legs being consumed, these ones that are coming from these countries, is there any testing being done at the moment to find out what kind of pesticide residues there are in them? Could these potentially be hazardous to the people who are consuming them?
It could be. I'm not aware of such testing. We recommend to do that. And we also should think about the health risks also for people in the range states, because of course in these countries the pesticide use may have a tremendous impact on human health.
Surely, Sandra, farming frogs would be a very lucrative source of income for the people in Indonesia or Turkey or Albania. I mean, frogs produce a huge amount of spawn, and if you were to actually farm them and keep away their natural predators, you would have a huge crop. So surely it would behove some of the people there to actually set up frog farms rather than catching them from the wild at all. Is there no help or no grants or no subsidies given to countries to actually farm frogs?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we expected that over the last two or three decades, this development would increase. And the interesting thing is that, for example, the USA is also a big importer of frogs and frogs' legs, but they mainly import frogs from farms, from Latin America and also from Asia. But the strange thing is that the European Union, whether it's for historic reasons or for whatever, we are mainly importing from Indonesia, and most of the frogs from there are taken from the wild. In Turkey, we have a mixture of farmed and wild-caught frogs, and the farms are also catching frogs from the wild to restock their farms. So in this case, we are not in the position to just have farmed frogs on the plate. And the main reason for that is that nature is producing much cheaper. And it's a little bit tricky to farm frogs because they are very sensitive to external conditions and to diseases, to water quality. So it's tricky. And many companies just rely on wild caught because it's cheaper.
But in Europe, I mean, for example, in France, they do actually farm frogs in France, so it is possible to do. Would it not be a better approach to try and change EU regulation so that only farmed frogs can be imported, and that would be part of the regulation of importing into the EU with frogs? I mean, wouldn't that be better? If there was no market for them, then they wouldn't be catching them in Indonesia. So, I mean, changing the EU regulation so that only farmed frogs can be imported, would that not be the way forward?
Everything is better than what we have at the moment, yes. The problem might be if we have a new regulation just importing farmed frogs, because the chain in the trade is pretty long and it could be difficult to prove whether they are really farmed or whether they are wild caught. And as you mentioned, the farms in France, yes, it's true, but the production level is very low. So it's not at all meeting the demand. What we would need and encourage is farming at a larger scale in France to satisfy the demand and not to import.
Sandra, I'm curious, have there been any steps taken to actually try to reduce that demand among consumers by explaining the ecological problems that this is causing for these species and to try and get consumers to make more informed choices so that there won't be such demand for these frogs' eggs? I know that the tradition of eating them goes back a long way, but we've had to all make many changes in our lives. Is this one that the people in France and elsewhere should consider making?
Yes, and this is exactly why we are trying to catch public attention, and we are glad about reports and interviews just like this, because everything contributes to a broader awareness. And we are cooperating with a French NGO in this context, because we, of course, need awareness created in the main market. Yeah, that's what we are trying to achieve. And we are also cooperating with French scientists and also with some politicians. But we are fighting against a big thing.
Sandra, I must confess that I have eaten frogs' legs, only experimentally, by the way, and in China, where they feed you these things. So I have an excuse, but I have eaten frogs' legs. And it struck me, nowadays there's talk of manufacturing artificial meat, laboratory meat. And my recollection of the cuisse de grand huile is not really that vivid. I think it tasted a bit like fishy chicken or something like that. I would have thought it was probably a fairly easy thing to recreate that artificially. Now, over there in China, there was an enormous frog. I think it was the East Asian bullfrog. I saw it in the wild and I thought it was that. It seemed to me if I was going to harvest frogs, I would concentrate on these big species, because you get a better return per catch on a big frog than you would from the little ones we have here that take 3.5 years to mature. So is there, the IUCN keeps tabs on the vulnerability of species. Are there frogs now on the threatened list and the endangered list under the IUCN? Or is there bias within the harvesting towards certain species over others?
Yes, we have some of the most targeted frogs which are now on the red list. For example, the giant Javan frog is now listed as vulnerable. And the populations of many of the species which are caught are at least decreasing. I mean, we are talking about common frogs, because otherwise you can't catch them by millions. But even common frogs can come to a point where the numbers are declining and they can't stand the exploitation level. And this is what we observe. What we see is, and DNA analyses have confirmed that, is that the larger-legged frog species are already in decline and they are filled in by smaller species. And because you mentioned the Asian bullfrog, indeed, Vietnam is separate and different from the other countries, which I mentioned before. Vietnam is farming frogs on a commercial scale, pretty successful, and the EU is also importing from Vietnam. And these are mainly these Asian bullfrogs and American bullfrogs, which are a problem when they are farmed in Asia because they are highly invasive.
Frogs are endangered anyway. It's not just this particular problem. There's viruses that strike them and there's all kinds of problems. Now, there is a curious problem they have, I gather, of sensitivity to ultraviolet light, which seems very strange in an animal that can change its colour using the light, that it should be vulnerable to the light. Is there anything in that area that can help you?
The problem with frogs is that they are threatened by so many factors. The climate crisis, diseases, the deadly fungus, and exploitation is just on top of all these threats.
So what should we do if we encounter a frog? How can we help it? Or what action should the ordinary person in the field do, if any?
What we need is to get this problem into the public, to educate, to create awareness, and in the best case, to reduce demand.
Well, that's what you're doing tonight. So thank you very much indeed, Sandra. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
As usual, details can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Well, you know the Dawn Chorus is creeping up on us. 7th of May this year, we'll be broadcasting from Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve and Cove. That's the main location for for our outside broadcast and has been since the year 2000. In fact, it was local man Jim Wilson, our ornithologist based there in Cove, who first suggested we broadcast from Kuskany for very good reason. Mixed habitat and close proximity. Bigger variety of birds, all singing at once. Anyway, Jim was out for a stroll the other day on the reserve and he noticed a very early singer. You know what it is. A robin.
Hi, Derek. I just decided to come out and go for a stroll in one of my favourite places, which a lot of the listeners are very familiar with. I'm here. I'm at Kuskany Marsh. And it's nice and peaceful. And just at the entrance to where we'll be setting up to do the dawn chorus, I've got a little friend up here in the bush. It's a robin. And it's got the stage all to itself. Unlike when we do the dawn chorus in May, you can hear it there in the background and it hasn't much competition. It's getting in early. I mean, robins will breed quite early, so this one is setting up territory without so much competition, getting in ahead of the group. You know, if we get a few mild days, when the days are starting to stretch in time as well, it can kickstart the odd robin or two. And here it is, just here at the end, like it's almost like as if it's guarding it for us. It's almost like saying, we're going to be doing the dawn chorus here, so, you know, we don't want anybody else coming in and stealing our show. It's not very strident. You know, there's not as much force in the song as there will be later when there are other robins competing. Mm-hmm. Whereas at the moment, it's almost maybe like a practice in some respects. It's very relaxed up there now on the bush. It's up in a hawthorn and it's just chilling away and singing, but staking its claim.
Still. Doesn't seem to be bothered by you.
Not at all. Robins are an unusual bird in the sense, like, you know, the gardeners are used to them.
I know the gardener's friend, but anytime I try to record the robin outside my house, it takes me forever because as soon as I take out the recording equipment, it's gone.
Well, that's the recorder's curse, isn't it? You know, it's when you don't have the recorder, you hear the best recordings. But that's what's happening here is that you just got lucky and it's more interested in other robins. And as I say, staking his claim than it is in being worried about you trying to catch it or anything like that.
And how is he looking?
Ah, the robin, I mean, at the moment, it's looking a little bit dishevelled, actually, that one. You can still see the orangey-red breast. I mean, it's not a crimson red. It's actually an orange more than a red, I would say, than a proper red. And you can actually see the beak. When you see it in profile, you can see the beak moving as it projects its voice from its syrinx, which is the equivalent of our larynx. In fact, it's like two, like a pair of larynx, whatever a pair, what is the plural of larynx, larynxes or larynxi. Anyway, it's
Larry's.
One at the top of each section of the lung, the bronchus, each of those, and it's producing these beautiful fluid sounds, and I always call them free jazz. You know, they don't repeat the same phrase over and over again like we say a song thrush or something like that, or a chaffinch. It's no two phrases are the same, and it rapid fire, you know, again like someone improvising on a guitar, you know, virtuoso playing really fast, and it's nice. Cool.
He's getting ahead of the game, as you said,
very much
staking his claim, and it is a he after all.
It is at this stage, it would be a he. Winter singing females can sing too sometimes to stake a claim, but now, you're definitely getting into the real
close
business.
Close to the end of March now.
Yeah, the courtship will be cranking up. And as I say, we've already had records of robins nesting already.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, okay. You get the odd one or two every year. If the conditions are right and the robins think there's enough food and they get a mile gap between the cold spells, they'll try.
I've seen them prospecting in my garden.
Aha.
And I've seen two together.
Oh,
so I'm assuming it's a couple.
Yeah.
So they've already paired off.
Well, at this stage, I've seen two male robins with a standoff in the garden already.
Standoff. That's how you know.
Oh my god!
Males.
Yeah, because they wouldn't really tolerate each other.
Yeah, I know that.
Otherwise,
And
because you couldn't tell if it was a male and a female. No, you wouldn't really.
But when there's two males and they make the most bizarre shapes when they're shaping up to each other. It's all about the breast and sort of, you know, threatening. There's no actual physical contact unless in a very rare occasion they're stubborn, but normally that's enough.
It's a Donnybrook gym.
Is that how Donnybrook? Yeah, yes, Donnybrook. Of
course. Did you ever see the movie The Quiet Man?
Long, long, long. Yes, John that's right. Wayne. Where they were looking from Kerry and they were looking over to County Clare or something. They'd spliced everything together.
Well, there's a famous scene. There is. Film buffs will remember. And they're going down the country boreen. And Barry Fitzgerald is riding behind them on the horse and trap.
Yeah.
He's the matchmaker.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And Maureen O'Hara and John Wayne are having a row. And he says, is this a Corton or a Donnybrook?
Yeah.
And the word Donnybrook means riot.
That's right.
And that's where I'm from. That's how I know it. But at any rate, that's what it means. I've only ever heard somebody use it once in real life, and that was on a tour on the River Hudson in New York.
So,
and the guy was talking about various things in the history of New York, and he mentioned a Donnybrook, and I couldn't believe it. And I told him I'm actually from that place. But at any rate, so that's what the two male robins were doing. They're having a bit of an argy-bargy.
They were having an argy-bargy.
Well, a kind of two bird ride. Anyway, you're mentioning the Dawn Chorus, and we're talking about the Dawn Chorus, and it's all ahead of us now, and you're going to start to hear more and more birds sing early in the morning and even at dusk.
Oh, yeah.
But you're not going to be part of it this year, the live broadcast, that is.
No, I'm afraid work has gotten the way. I do actually do some other work. I'm going to be on the high seas, which is where I earn my main income from, wildlife tour leading on small ships. And we'll be going around Britain and Ireland. And I'll be somewhere off Scotland on the weekend.
And 7th of May.
Great shame. 7th of May.
So maybe we'll be able to speak to you anyway. With a bit of luck,
if I'm not busy looking after people, you know, on a hike or something like that.
But we've got a great super sub.
We do. Alan Farrell. Note that name down. You'll say, I remember hearing him first on the radio. Alan, great guy, passionate about birds, very knowledgeable about Kuskinny.
Which is most important for us.
Well, absolutely.
The
local
broadcast coming from Kuskinny Marsh Nature Reserve. Anyway, Jim, we have to thank you publicly. This is a good opportunity because if it weren't for you, we wouldn't have ever found Kuskinny Marsh Nature Reserve as our main location each year for the live broadcast of the Dawn Chorus. Can you imagine? We've been broadcasting the Dawn Chorus in one manner, shape or form for 28 years, but 23 years on and off.
Yeah.
From Kuskinny Marsh Nature Reserve. And boy, it's been good. Even when the weather was bad, it was still good.
Yeah, we've had it all. Like we've been overall fortunate.
Very
actually.
Lucky. Yeah, yeah.
We've had, like, I think, was it last year or the year before? It was horrible on Friday, Saturday, and it was horrible on Sunday. But we
during
got
the
that
broadcast,
gap.
Yeah.
It was perfect. Yeah. It was fine. And we've had rain. And did it ever stop the birds?
No.
Not
no,
once.
Even the wind.
It never will. Never will.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. Yeah. Make a note in your diary. So this year's Dawn Chorus will be on Sunday, the 7th of May. We'll go live from midnight on RTÉ Radio 1. So think of Saturday the 6th and then midnight through to 7 a.m. And we'll be partnering again with RTÉ Radio Lyric FM. Hopefully with BBC Radio Ulster, with BBC Radio Scotland and with BBC Radio Wales. And then we hope to hear from members of Birdwatch Ireland and listeners to Moonee Goes Wild from every county in Ireland and indeed the islands. We're looking forward to hearing the corncrake off the northwest coast with a bit of luck. And we may get a cuckoo and then we'll get all the local species here at the mixed habitat that we have here at Kuskinny Marsh Nature Reserve. Anyway, Jim, thanks for bringing that to us. That was
no
interesting.
Problem, eh? Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's such a pleasure to be able to have a broadcast from what is actually a reasonably average part of the Irish countryside. This is one of the other reasons why we like coming here, is that wherever you live, you have pretty good chance of hearing most of what we're broadcasting. It's not somewhere where, you know, you have to travel for miles and miles and it's only that one place where you hear this, that and the other. It's a slice of Ireland and it's a slice of the Irish Dawn Chorus.
I think the robin has stopped singing behind you.
I think it's listening to us at the moment. Actually, it's in subsong at the moment. It's kind of whispering. You can barely hear it. Yeah, you can see the wings and the body moving as it... Incredible.
You know what? It is incredible. It's fantastic working with the likes of Jim Wilson, Éanna Ní Lána, Terry Flanagan, Niall Hatch, Richard Collins, Dr. Matthew Jebb, Eric Dempsey, John O'Halloran in Cork. These guys really know their stuff. And it's an absolute pleasure to listen to them listening to the birds singing. So the Dawn Chorus will be broadcast live on RT Radio 1 and RT Lyric FM on Sunday the 7th of May. Make a note in your diary. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to everybody who contributed to tonight's programme. Our broadcast coordinator is Daniel Keating and our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly. We'll do it all again next week. Until then, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.